Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark, and I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I have a cold, but nothing would keep me from this podcast.
I'm very happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, here's an odd story from our friends at Semaphore. Ben Smith reports that the folks at Bloomberg, quote, quietly killed a splashy PR rollout of Olivia Nuzzi's new show, Working Capital, in response to a small Twitter campaign against the journalist by Democrats, end quote. The program still aired, but no one really heard about it. I had not heard about it. I remember there was a big announcement in July. I was like, ooh, new show with Olivia. This is going to be exciting. And then didn't really hear anything about it until I saw this story. This small group of very vocal Democrats, they were mad at her for her very damning story about Joe Biden's mental state as the post-debate push for him to step down picked up steam. I don't know if you guys read that when it dropped, but it was a pretty devastating look at how out of it Biden was, and was no small factor in getting people to call for him to step down. Anyway, these Democrats, they were annoyed and angry that she had pointed out that Biden was at best not all there. The activists on Twitter highlighted old, out of context jokes that she had made about, among other things, Obama being, you know, a quote, Kenyan anti-colonialists. They were decrying her as racist. Obviously, she was making fun of this whole thing. But, you know, it's always hard to say in the context-free environment of tweets that do not exist surrounded by other tweets in your timeline. Bloomberg, hoping to avoid a scandal, simply buried the series. They didn't kill it outright. They just were like, yeah, well, we'll just post this and be done with it. In his newsletter, Ben Smith noted that this is, quote, a microcosm of one of the real struggles for corporate media right now, which is looking for a new generation of stars with social media followings, big personalities, and clear identities. People who have built that kind of following and reputation over the last decade have probably made out-of-context jokes or even said actually regrettable things over the years. Their corporate employers prefer ciphers or at least careful television professionals, and it's hard to have it both ways, end quote. Nuzzi herself seems ambivalent about the affair, noting that she understands Bloomberg's POV here and is used to being accused of bias by both left and right. But she has made a point of not deleting her tweets over the years, despite the chance of something like this happens, just on general principle. Yeah, it's funny. This is almost a throwback social media controversy, right? It's been a while since we had something so egregiously silly and petty and, frankly, bad faith pick up actual traction like this. But as Ben says, it's something that any public-facing organization or individual is going to have to figure out how to deal with more and more as we go forward. It's something that comes up more and more frequently in the political sphere. I mean, even a guy like J.D. Vance, right? And there are a million things to criticize J.D. Vance for. I'm pretty sure I've criticized him for like 940,000 of them. But a couple weeks back, I saw people passing around pictures of him, I think, passed out in college or, you know, doing something silly in a bathroom with girls in his high school. And people were like, oh, this is so damning. And I was like, I don't know, man. It's a kid having fun. I don't know. I am like the first generation of Facebook and Twitter users. And I have to say, if like out of context jokes or photos from parties in college are going to be political deal breakers, we're going to have an entire lost generation. There's nobody from this era is going to survive in the public square. Peter, how should Bloomberg have handled this? What is the proper response to somebody making bad faith allegations of racism because they wrote a story you didn't like?
Well, on the one hand, I don't think that this was the way to handle it. And I frankly, I just don't understand what was done here. Right? Like, before we even get to like what the right way is, like, this doesn't make any sense to me. Like, if you're really truly embarrassed by the show, you think that there's something wrong with the host or the product, then you got to pull it. Because that's right. Because if the show is bad, but they clearly don't think that. And to be clear, I think Nuzzi is an excellent journalist, and I haven't seen the show, but I would guess that it's a quality piece of journalism. If you think it's bad, you pull it. If you don't think it's bad, why would you release it hoping that no one sees it? Like, what's the? That's shooting yourself in the foot here.
Oh, see, that makes total sense to me. That's the part of the story that actually makes the most sense to me from Bloomberg's perspective. Because if you kill it, then you create a whole cycle of stories, Streisand affecting it. Sure. The story becomes Bloomberg kills a news program at the behest of activists. And then you get into a whole series of fights about that. But this is the nature of streaming, right? Streaming is an infinite morass. You can dump anything you want somewhere in streaming and it'll just kind of disappear if you don't give any attention to it.
But if you're going to pay to make a show and build out someone who you hope will produce, will like be a star, and is like, you hired this person, right? Because you thought that this was going to produce something that was good and viable in the long run. And then like, you don't promote it. It just doesn't make any sense to me. It seems like a very strange reaction just in terms of like the business part of it. But culturally, politically, it makes total sense. I mean, the thing that is in the Semaphore piece that gets brought up is that this would not have happened if the comparable complaints had come from the right, from Republicans, from, say, MAGA. It was because, you know, it was because it was Democrats that Bloomberg became unnerved by this. And that seems to be the issue here. And so they wanted just to make it go away. And you're right. This is the easiest way to just make it go away, which is to really sit very quietly with no promotion at all, hoping that no one watches it. So you don't have to renew it. So everyone just forgets that it ever happened. So it makes sense on that level, but it doesn't make any sense as a business decision to me. And that's what's crazy, is because Bloomberg is like one of the remaining really excellent journalism businesses. They are incredibly profitable, as far as I know. Disclosure, my wife worked at Bloomberg Opinion for several years. Hasn't worked there since, I think, 2016. I have no inside knowledge of anything but like, it's just well known. They are a profitable and successful journalism enterprise, and to sort of have this, to have a product that they have invested in that they are trying to build out, and then they don't want people to see it, seems very strange to me, just from a business perspective, because like there's just this sort of weird timidity around this. Like either push these things and market them, or pull them completely, but don't do this thing that's in the, like, it doesn't, I don't know. There's not a right, the right response here would have been to just be like, who cares about these people? And market the show and say, we've got a great show. We're proud of it. You should watch it.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there are a couple of challenges here. And in this respect, sort of media outlets have a very similar problem to universities, which is that they have not really sat down and figured out sort of what their broad stance on, you know, what it is okay for a contributor to have said and what it is not. And then they have not made the corresponding decision to stick to their guns when people throw a tantrum about something. And, you know, Bloomberg theoretically should have a very different pain point than a different kind of publication, right? I mean, it is, you know, largely subscribers. It's largely like institutional subscriptions and people who are paying for it for business intelligence. And so they're much less vulnerable than many comparable publications, including the Washington Post, to, you know, a bunch of people just individually getting honked at them and giving up their subscriptions as sort of a way to express displeasure with an editorial decision. And so Bloomberg theoretically should have a much higher pain threshold for this kind of thing and should be able to say, like, yeah, a bunch of people who are yelling at us on the internet who don't have institutional subscriptions are mad at us. This is a good show by a person with a good voice whose, you know, voice is somewhat edgy but well within bounds. Obviously, we're going to stick by her and continue to market it. And so, you know, I think if all of these institutions had more clearly articulated principles for what was in bounds, what was out of bounds, and why, you know, given their, you know, particular positioning, right? Like, Yeshiva University is going to have a different, like, is going to have a much lower threshold for, like, anything remotely Nazi adjacent, no matter how unintentional or accidental, than, you know, some other public, like, there's just, institutions are individuals. They need to figure out where their pressure points are. They need to articulate what the limits are clearly, and then they need to stick to them consistently. And, you know, we are, you know, more than a decade into this kind of explosion without people seeming to have figured that out particularly well. And it's, you know, it is somewhat strange to me. Like, if you look at what's happening at a lot of universities now around discipline for protests around the war between Israel and Hamas, you will notice that, like, big universities like Harvard have imposed different standards on undergraduates, on professional schools. Like, there are just these inconsistencies in both sort of media and the academy that, you know, end up hurting all of these institutions because they have not taken the time and developed the courage to actually have standards.
Yeah, and that's the real issue here, is there is just a complete lack of backbone in these organizations. And this is not to say that all staffers should be defended at all times for all things that they say. Obviously, every institution is going to have lines that you cannot or should not cross. But, like, again, what strikes me about this is just how transparently bad faith it is, too. And that's the other thing really here, is that, like, it's not just that it's bad faith, and it's not just that, you know, they're cherry picking out of context stuff. It's that the attack is very explicitly inspired by negative coverage of a preferred protected candidate.
Who is, by the way, out of the race, right? Like, there's no point in continuing to protect Joe Biden. He is out of the race for the reasons that Olivia Nuzzi's reporting suggested he should be out of the race. Like, it's done. This is fighting the last war in a way that makes very little sense to me personally.
Well, I mean, it makes sense if you view a particular kind of politics as an exercise in vindictive control, you know, vindictiveness and controlling, right? And reminding people what you can do to them in their careers even if they publish something that is totally true. There are, I believe, no corrections on Nuzzi's piece. Certainly has not been, like, pulled back. Like, it's not only just, like, right, it's journalistically accurate, and then also it turned out to be, like, really, really true. We all, like, which is why Joe Biden is no longer in the race. But it looks to me like a sort of exercise in kind of delayed revenge, right? It's like, just to let people know, oh, look, even if it's true, you can be hurt later by us. And that is one of the things that bothers me so much about this, is that Bloomberg allowed that to happen.
Yep.
And, like, institutions don't have to. Frankly, a great promotion for a show like this would have been, Democratic operatives are trying to kill this show because they're mad. Here's the thing that they don't want you to see, right? Like, that's, but that, of course, doesn't happen. Certainly a handful of very well-known, successful major media outlets when it's Democrats. And that is the difference here, is that this would have been just laughed out of the room if it were Republicans. I'm not inferring this. This is explicit in the Semaphore story. And the fact that it was high-level Democratic operatives means that the executives at Bloomberg probably also, this sort of thing, right, happens, or, like, this sort of pressure exists, influence exists at other news organizations as well. And that's a real problem. And, like, you need to treat those folks like the hack operatives that they are, and just say, nope, you don't get to push us around like that.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that Bloomberg kind of sort of disappeared Olivia Nuzzi's new show because a handful of activists were angry that she accurately reported Joe Biden has no business running for re-election? Peter?
It's a controversy.
Stupid. Alyssa?
Controversy. It's a controversy.
It's a controversy. Don't give in to the dumb activists. Just tell them to get bent. That's the Sunny Bunch way. All right, make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Looking forward to the award season rush. Reviews are rolling in from Venice and Telluride as folks get ready to head off to Toronto. Festivals, baby, they're back. What are we, the three of us, anticipating? What are we looking forward to? What should you good folks out there be looking forward to? Get circled on your calendar. for its release. We'll discuss all that and more on Friday. And now on to the main event. A Quiet Place, Day One. Now, we're doing this movie this week, even though it came out in theaters about 2 months ago, because A, it just hit Paramount Plus, so you can stream it. You can watch it for free if you have Paramount Plus, or you can rent it on VOD, whatever. Also because it's Labor Day weekend, and there's not really that many new options in theaters this week. Apologies to anyone out there who was hoping for a tight 20 on the new Ronald Reagan biopic starring Dennis Quaid, but I don't know if you guys have seen the trailer for that one. Made me kind of want to die just watching it. It really looks bad. So we decided to skip that. There's another reason we wanted to watch A Quiet Place Day One, and that's because it's directed by Michael Cernovsky, who wrote and directed 2021's Pig, which I believe, you guys, it was the movie that all three of us picked for the best film that year, right?
Wasn't that? That is correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. So all three of us love that, and we wanted to talk about his new one, which is, again, A Quiet Place Day One. It's the prequel to the 2018 hit A Quiet Place, starring John Krasinski and Emily Blunt. In this film, Lupita Nyong'o stars as Samira, a poet in hospice who heads into New York City after being promised a slice of pizza when she and her dying friends get done watching their puppet show. It's kind of dark. You know, we're in the hospice, then we're in New York, we're gonna get some pizza. Things are gonna get worse, though. Things are going to get worse. The hospice center nurse, Henry, gets called back. He's played by Alex Wolff, who was also in Sarnowski's Pig. He gets called by the hospice center to bring the crew home. They don't make it, as the aliens from the series, which have super powerful hearing and attack viciously anything that moves, or anything that makes a sound, anything that they hear that doesn't sound like nature, they attack the island of Manhattan before the bus can leave. Samira, knowing that she doesn't have long and that the world doesn't seem to have much longer than she does, decides to head away from the water where an evacuation is happening and head toward a pizza parlor she wanted to eat at one last time. Joining her is her cat, which is frequently getting her into trouble with the monsters, and Eric, played by Joseph Quinn, who is shell-shocked and just trying to survive. All in all, the film is pretty effective, right? Decent tension, very good acting. It looks good. It looks like a real movie. And that is what Cernovsky brings to the table here. It's what helps set Pig apart from so many of the other Nick Cage VOD movies that we get a million of every year, it feels like, right? This guy has a real eye, a real sense for lighting and mood. He's got a good sense of pacing and how to frame a shot. The man is a talented visual storyteller, and he also has a decent way. He adds some nice touches of humanity to the proceedings, again, as he did in Pig. There's a whole moment where, again, involving food and community and all that. I'm sure you guys will talk more about that. It's nice, though I did feel like it was a little bit of a rehash from Pig. Done better in Pig, I'll put it that way. I have to say, I've watched this movie twice now. I saw it in theaters opening weekend and liked it a fair amount. Like, was pretty impressed because I don't think I was expecting very much. I liked it a little less on second viewing when I was watching it at home, at least in part because it's a slight film. There's really no reason for this to exist. But really mostly because I'd rather, and look, this is a, you know, this isn't the movie's fault. It's the industry's fault. But I really would rather guys like Cernovsky be able to spend his time making stuff more like Pig than stuff like this. And I understand there's not a ton of space for indie filmmakers to follow their passion in the studio system, blah, blah, blah. But it's interesting to me that the guy who had been attached to this, there was a director attached to this before Cernovsky, is Jeff Nichols. He's the guy who made Mud and Take Shelter and Shotgun Stories and a bunch of other great kind of indie-ish, vibe-ish movies. He dropped out and he wound up making The Bike Riders instead. The Bike Riders is great. One of my favorite films of the year. Will probably wind up in my top 10. Fun, original, great performances. Just a nice little piece of original filmmaking of the sort we don't get enough of anymore. A Quiet Place Day One, again, it's better than it has any right to be. I remain a little wary of the indie director to blockbuster filmmaking pipeline. Into which they have to smuggle their ideas, like, hey, you know what's delicious is pizza. Pizza in the apocalypse. Gotta love it. Again, solid film. Enjoyable. I will end up giving this a thumbs up, but I do... the whole thing makes
spoilers.
Me feel a little sad. Alyssa, what did you make of A Quiet Place Day One?
I like this a lot, and I think I liked it a lot, and probably may end up rating it higher than you, Sunny. I don't know about you, Peter. I know you really like this, in part because I, you know, as we discussed in last week's episode, I do not like, you know, scary, creepy, crawly, monstery, alien scare thingamabobs. I don't like jump scares.
So this is your favorite franchise?
Yes, of all the franchises. Yeah, like, I don't like gross aliens. I don't like jump scares.
Also set against terrifying pregnancy horror in the first one?
Yeah, well.
Yeah, did you see the first two, Alyssa?
I have not seen the first two. Okay. So I am coming. I'm also probably coming to this totally fresh, right? I am, you know, I'm basically like, oh, this is my first encounter with this whole concept. I mean, I knew the shtick, obviously. But yeah, this is temperamentally not my thing. And so I was probably a little bit surprised by how much I liked it. You know, there are a lot of things I enjoyed about this, but I want to talk first about Lupita Nyong'o's performance, because I think especially given her performances in 12 Years a Slave and the Black Panther movies, and, you know, her, and it also just in general, her look, like, she has sort of like big eyes. She is often cast as sort of like an innocent or a sort of pure figure. And having her play just someone who is like really, really grumpy about dying and someone who is going to do some stuff that for those of us who are not currently dying of cancer, it's just obviously irrational and reckless and nuts, is incredibly enjoyable, right? I mean, this movie opens with her, you know, reading this just incredibly abrasive poem about how much she both hates her hospice and everyone else in it. And then when the apocalypse arrives, she's like, you know what? I'm going to go uptown to Harlem. I'm going to go home and I'm going to have the slice of pizza that I really like. And basically, I'm going to die on my terms. And it's very interesting. I mean, in almost any other iteration of this movie, she would be miraculously cured. There'd be something about like the alien, whatever weird fiber egg stuff that cures her. But no, like, you can, because this is a movie by Michael Cernowski and because of the sort of general vibe of the movie, this is a movie about a woman dying on her terms, right? And, you know, watching it as a movie that's sort of fundamentally about like end of life care, as opposed to an apocalypse. Like, the apocalypse dramatizes the challenges of end-of-life care, but, like, I just really enjoyed watching it as a movie about end-of-life care, right? I mean, you know, there's a sequence in the movie where Eric goes looking for fentanyl patches for Samara because, you know, she left home with one fentanyl patch. She's really, really serious pain. And, you know, it is this movie about sort of the grace of ministering to other people in really challenging conditions, right? I mean, there's this scene where they break into either her old apartment or an apartment of someone she's sort of related to in search of her medication. They're able to talk a little bit because there is a thunderstorm that is drowning out their voices. And so she and Eric both have these sort of primal screams during thunderclaps. You know, the quest to get her just like a slice of New York pizza to have this sort of sensory experience before she dies. You know, I just thought, I mean, it's just a really tender movie about, you know, how hard it can be to usher someone through an experience that is both, you know, grotesquely unfair, physically humiliating, and also just very human and universal. And, you know, what is the best way to minister to someone? Is it to preserve their life at all costs, regardless of the quality of that life? Is it to give them sort of the dignity of, you know, being able to call some shots and have the experiences that they want to have on their way out? I found it, I mean, it's not as good a movie as Pig, but it also, if you look at a movie like Shang-Chi and the Seven Rings and compare that to Destin Daniel Cretton's Short Term 12, which is a movie I adore and think about all the time, the difference between what Cernowski has been able to accomplish here and making this a really personal, unusual entrant in a franchise relative to what Cretton is able to do with Shang-Chi within sort of the confines of the Marvel universe is just, there is not really a comparison there between sort of what Cernowski is able to do and accomplish in this movie, and what you know, it is possible for indie directors to do within the framework of like the Marvel franchise.
So you're really excited about him inevitably taking over on like Blade, which has now gone through like 10 different directors and 70 screenplays. And
as long as it's the one where it's about like a group of women like finding themselves and Blade is sort of orthogonal to it. Like if it's if Michael Cernowski directs that Blade script, then I am totally here for it.
Yeah, it's time for that movie to happen.
Alyssa, you talk about the end of life care stuff in this movie, which is obvious. This is like the point of the, if I was going to summarize the movies, distill the movie down to a single point, it might be this, which is death goes on.
Yeah.
Like she's dying. She knows she's dying. She doesn't want to die, cowering in a theater someplace waiting for the monsters to find her. She wants to go eat her pizza and go out on her own terms. And that is, it's interesting because that's almost the direct opposite of the first film. The first film, the theme of which, if you have to boil it down to a one sentence description, is probably life goes on. And the first one is very explicitly about rearing children in the end of the world. Like it is about the idea of continuing the process of bringing life into a world where death is everywhere. Again, so it's very, and I find that message, you know, just by itself more compelling and more interesting. But they are interestingly related in an inverted sort of way. Peter, you like this movie a lot. When you realized that this was a Michael Cernowski movie a couple weeks ago, you're like, oh, we have to do this. And yeah. I'm not opposed.
This is one of the better franchise films I've seen in a long time. Now, it's sort of like, granted, this year it is also competing with Mad Max Furiosa and with Dune 2, both of which I really, really, really liked. But let's set those aside for a moment, because this is what you're supposed to get from hiring an interesting young director to do a franchise film. You're supposed to get a franchise film that clearly takes part in that franchise's universe and delivers on, you know, the promise of, in this case, a particular sort of alien monster thriller type movie. But it also really, really, really just feels like these are the ideas that animate this director, and these are the stylistic tricks and concepts that this director has used before and is bringing to bear on this, you know, on this franchise and on its kind of core promise. Because if you go back and you look at Pig, Sonny, I know you rewatched it recently. I don't know if you did, Alyssa, but I watched it again over the weekend, and it's even better than I remembered. Also, even sadder in many ways. And end of life care is really built into that film. There is this great sort of very sad but very fitting subplot in which the young guy character in that movie tells Nicolas Cage's character, oh, well, you know, my mom committed suicide. Obviously, he's gonna. And then we find out that she's still in a facility. She seems to be basically non-communicative. It's not totally clear exactly. It's just one short scene. He has not actually been able to process the trauma of her not dying, because she is in this sort of liminal state of being in some ways sort of dead as a person, but still alive and still there as a body that he can go visit. And that scene then pays off even more when they go back to his dad's place and cook the meal. Because if you watch and you see when he invites his dad out for the meal and he's watching his dad and is in the office that his father has retreated to, he speaks from outside the room in almost exactly the same position. It's almost exactly the same shot, right? He's treating his mother and his father. His father, of course, is still quite like the same way. And you get all of that stuff in like a big summer alien adventure, alien action film here. Like all of that same sort of stuff repeats itself in A Quiet Place Day One. And that's what I loved about this most, is that it was so recognizably a personal film by a specific filmmaker rather than a studio designed product that a filmmaker had to kind of come in and maybe add a few touches of their own, a few ideas, but basically they were there to produce something that looked, felt, and acted like the corporate studio product. Nothing wrong with a corporate studio product, but I love, but like one of the reasons we love the Alien franchise is that that franchise was built on in particular, the first four films, each was directed by a different director, and they all have incredibly different tonal, stylistic aesthetics. And they all feel really, really, really like the other director's works. I mean, even if you dislike Alien 3 and Alien Resurrection, they are very recognizably David Fincher films and Jean-Pierre Jeunet films, right? Like these are movies that are so clearly by those directors. They could not possibly have been directed by anyone else. And this is another film like that, where this movie could not possibly have been directed by anybody but Michael Cernowski, but by the same guy who directed Pig. And that's what really excites me about this. It also just works really well on its own terms. There are great little tight set pieces. There's really smart use of a different setting for the franchise. So the first two films take place in, the first one's sort of on a farm. The second one is kind of through trails, and there's an industrial setting. But this brings the aliens into the city and gives you an urban setting and shows you what it would be like in a, you know, incredibly populated area, right? So there's just some sort of franchise lore stuff that, right, is some expansion there. Anyway, I'm super stoked when I see a big franchise film that also feels like a personal little film. I'm also super stoked these days when it looks great and you realize the budget on this is less than $70 million. I mean, this movie looks a lot better than a lot of the things that we have seen that cost two or three times as much and run, you know, 2 hours and 40 minutes. And you're just like, what the hell is this thing? This movie, it just feels like it was designed by a person, and all the parts and the pieces are there because some specific individual who has a particular taste and a particular aesthetic, that person wanted all of these parts to be in there and to fit together like this. That's so rare these days. Again, Furiosa and Dune 2 are kind of weird exceptions that we had a couple of these this year. But that's so rare these days in summer franchise films that, you know, that are big genre productions. And I loved it. I loved the way that it was about sadness and death and finding community through food in the midst of the apocalypse, which is exactly what Pig is about.
But more than just food, I mean, it's really about care in a slightly broader way. Like, pizza is part of it, but there is this sort of sense of the sort of physical laying on of hands and sticking by someone. You know, there is this... there's this section. Have either of you read Patricia Lockwood's No One Is Talking About This?
I think actually I did.
It's really wonderful. It's basically the book follows a sort of internet poison character. And this is based in part on Lockwood's actual experience, who has kind of snapped out of her internet poisoned reverie when her sister gives birth to a daughter who's...
I did read that, actually.
Yeah, who is going to die very young. And when the baby dies, there's this passage about how everything that they do sort of in service of the baby's memory, no matter how sort of tacky or ridiculous, acquires this kind of holiness. And, you know, the TJ Maxx where the girls texted each other pictures from their respective dressing rooms was holy. The shoe carnival where they staggered up and down the aisles almost laughing. The Michaels where they chose poster board. And it's just sort of, it is this section of the novel about, you know, this kind of tenderness and attention that lend a depth and glimmer to these sort of everyday gestures. And I think at its best, you know, Quiet Place Day One is about the sort of transformation that comes from paying attention, from caring for someone when it's difficult, from noticing details, right? There is this moment where Samara finds an abandoned bookshop and sits just having this sort of sensual experience with a copy of Octavia Butler's Dawn. And again, it's, you know, what makes that moment so in the film so special is not even, you know, a sort of heavy-handed quotation from it, but, you know, a sort of a sense of attention to the physical experience of a book, and in particular this book that obviously means something to her. You know, it's the care that Eric puts into, you know, putting on this last little show, this little moment, this, you know, this moment of magic for Samara without words, with this, you know, 24-hour-old, 99-cent pizza, you know. And it just, there's no mistake that some of his physical care of her takes place in a church, right? I mean, this is a movie about sort of the holiness of our own attention. And Pig is much less explicitly religious than this movie is. But, you know, I think that it's not just sort of food. It's not just sort of caregiving. It's the idea that our attentiveness has the ability to create sort of holy meaning out of the mundane. And I just, that's a remarkable thing for a filmmaker to have settled on as a subject and to get to put into a $70 million movie. And so it's sort of the gulf between like franchise movie and this specific intellectual project that, and seeing that bridged is very exciting to me.
Yeah, it's funny when I was rewatching it last night, and I was like, this was a relatively cheap film, and you could kind of see the seams, at least in the sense of, like, it's very clearly shot on a set. It's shot on a studio backlot. You know, whenever somebody goes up to a rooftop to look out at the carnage, you're like, okay, this is obviously a big blue screen that they're looking at. And there is again, you pick up on that a little more clearly at home, maybe in slightly lower definition than in a theater. But more movies should be shot this way, frankly. More movies should be shot on backlots, not on location, if it means that you can be good and a little bit smaller.
I was going to ask you both about this because I was watching this for the first time, and I did think the seams in the CGI showed a little bit when you have the aliens sort of skittering around the buildings, New York, sort of rushing through things. But I actually thought this was an interesting case where the sort of cheapness of the CGI kind of added to the uneasiness of it because, you know, it's sort of obviously CGI, but it kind of also feels like, oh, this is something that is totally alien, that doesn't quite function plausibly, and yet it's functioning and killing these characters on my screen. And I don't know if that was intentional or not, but it was the way that it played to me. And it was really interesting that some of the limitations of the CGI actually served to enhance the horror, at least for me.
I would just say that this franchise has always had pretty remarkable budget control. The first film was made for under $20 million and looks really quite good. And it doesn't, like, these movies are shot in a way that makes it so that if the effects aren't the most impressive you've ever seen, it's not the most detailed, you know, alien, whatever, it's CGI that you've ever seen in your life, it still works, because what's effective about the scenes isn't the hyper physicality of the aliens or the way that they sort of seamlessly blend into reality. What's effective is that they focus on the mood and the capabilities and just the psychological terror of being in that situation, of being hunted or whatever it is, under attack, and also not being able to scream, not being able to make a single noise, not being able to even break a twig or whatever it is. It's about, the movies are built around the fear of that experience much more than, oh, look at this monster that we built for you in a computer.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on A Quiet Place Day One? Peter.
Thumbs up.
Alyssa.
Thumbs up.
Thumbs up. My quibbles aside, it's an entertaining, well-made picture. So I don't have too serious a complaint, but I will. All right. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Sebastian Hughes, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love this episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.